I mean, well, this next question could go either way, but the one is the question of whether there will be a second vote in any form of second vote on the referendum, but also just if that happened, or one of the things that people are saying is that it would give even more succour to the far right. And then the other thing that you go back into the book and you see where the rise of Hungary's far right came from in 2010 and so on. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not saying anything new to say the far right is sort of circling here, but you've got Steve Bannon now coming over.
Yeah.
You know, there's this sort of idea they're going to export this sort of alt-right thing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, what other option would they have? They would have to circle the wagons and say, we are now truly the betrayed.
Yeah.
Given how much lip service was paid to the nature of the referendum result as a sovereign decision of the British people. I mean, all this language, which was totally alien, really, to the British political vocabulary.
Yeah.
And this massive sovereignty. Where did the sovereignty of Parliament go? Like, well, that used to be the discrimination. You know, that's what made British politics different, for better or worse. I mean, I'm no, like, fan of it, but, like, it's a huge cultural shift, and it's very difficult to get that genie back in the bottle.
Yeah.
So no, it's not... I mean, given my position, I wouldn't, I'd ram it down their throats happily.
Yeah.
And it would force the issue of cultural change, which to my mind was the issue that the British elite dodged from the 70s onwards. Like, they didn't solidly step behind this programme. Britain needed some coming to terms with the past, frankly.
Yeah.
About the empire, about Ireland, about its own screwed up relationship to Europe, what World War One and World War Two were really about at various points. And instead we got this weird, the British appropriation of the Holocaust and the imperial, as though this was integral to us because it was serving the purposes of a human rights agenda. Obviously, Holocaust education's a big deal. I wrote books about Nazi Germany for a reason, but it was completely gratuitous. Like, why isn't there a museum about Ireland?
Yeah.
Like, why isn't there a museum about India? Mm. Like, well, there is, but it's the V&A and it's some sort of cultural artifact. Well, we've got a fantastic museum about the Holocaust.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is an experience of some British people, but tiny. There was never a concerted move, as there was, say, in Germany, to digest the complexities of our 19th and 20th century history, which is crucial if you're going to do the European project seriously, because you really do have to get over some of your crap. You know, the French had to do this in 58 and 68 because of Algeria. Yeah, tore that society apart.
Yeah.
None of that happened in Britain over Ireland. Mm. Like, why not?
Mm-hmm.
No, why do we have these laughable debates about, where Ken Livingstone or Corbyn stood on the IRA at some point in the past, as though this was some trivial question as opposed to an absolutely fundamental question of British politics?
And we're willing to give up the Friday agreement.
Exactly. Where do we stand on this? Like, how is it conceivable that the Tories are in bed with that party in Northern Ireland?
Yeah.
Inconceivable.
Sure.
Despite, the appeasement, this is an illiberal force of the most pernicious variety that once upon a time would have been, beyond discussion.
Yeah.
And the Tory party in its prime knew it as well, right? Because these were spoilers. These are the people who really brought Britain to the brink. And anyway, so that for me is the deeper question. And now we're living with the consequences of that, because Britain really does have undoubtedly a hard right, nationalist, xenophobic potential, like most societies. And it's kind of untouched, right? It's native. I mean, in retrospect, I find coming back here, I was working here in the 90s and the 2000s, and you saw that Cool Britannia thing coming through, that kind of new self-confidence that was rather important for me in re-envisioning World War II in this Wages of Destruction book I wrote. And now I have to say, every time I see a Union Jack and a Bulldog, and every time I see some regional labelling on a Marks and Spencer's food package, I think, that's where this came from. Because we owned it. We owned it. This was for a while, this was all right. It was a bit like Swinging London in the 60s. But if you look back at Swinging London in the 60s, it's full of British flags as well.
Now
it just makes me fear. It's like Suez never happened. Like, how could that be cool after Suez? Mm. It was cool, though. The Beatles and the Stones were the coolest thing on the whole planet. And they rehabilitated being British. And that turns out to be a disaster.
One of the points in the book is that, everybody concentrated on trade wars and things like that and missed the fact that it was private sector banking falls. In that context, what about the current sort of move towards
trade wars? Same logic would hold. In other words, the trade wars so far discussed are bad news.
Mm.
Particularly bad news politically, I think.
Yeah.
Because they... Hi, just last question.
My last question.
Yeah, perfect timing.
Oh,
yeah.
So we're talking about the trade wars in Greg Ippitt in the Wall Street Journal had a good piece, which I thought was quite good. So the politics are terrible. They're part of this neo-nationalist, you know, repoliticization of the economy in this very unproductive way. There's lots of different ways of politicizing the economy. Many of them are essential. We should do it. Yeah. But like, this is the least productive way.
Right.
But it's like, this is... and especially, you know, the you know, this scattershot that, you know, to take on Mexico and Canada at the same time as the EU, at the same time as Chinese, and then all of the EMs as well. It's, I mean, it's just bewildering what's going on in Washington. So it's bad politically. It's an incredibly bad sign about the state of mind of Washington.
Yeah, yeah.
It will hurt certain sectors of the economy, you know, and it will hurt like very trade exposed economies like Mexico and Canada very badly. And Canada can afford it, Germany, I mean, but Mexico will really take a very severe hit.
Yeah.
Not is ever likely that the Americans will cut off trade with Mexico because they're too interactive.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the Mexican economy is really taking, well, it's on a roller coaster right now. When the news is good, it goes up and it's really painful. And you could imagine a kind of unwinding of the, there was this good, you know, somebody was saying with the China shock, you know, accounted for job losses of about 1 or 2 million, and that's the imports from China. If you unwind that, you maybe get 1 or 2 million jobs back, but you also have a churn of about 5 or 6 million people who have to change their occupations to get you that, right? So it's hugely disruptive, even if the overall impact is not that large. But absolutely stick to my guns on the trade versus finance. Trade is a kind of arthritis or flu. No, it's not flu, but it's like an arthritis type.
Yeah.
You know, it's a question of the general flexibility of the world economy, things you can do and not do, how mobile you are, you know, or some sort of like stunting phenomenon, whether the global economy can progress in certain directions, for better or worse.
Yeah.
You can argue about them, but whether it can grow. Finance generates heart attack type symptoms, and that's a qualitatively different phenomenon, and there aren't very many of them in global economic history. There's only really two, and 2008 is much more dramatic than the 1930s. This is what people don't, because it never really culminated. People don't realise, I mean, those 2 months, September, October 2008, are undoubtedly the most terrifying in the global history of ever.
Yeah.
No, there's nothing in 1929 because it's market by market was very slow. You know, the Great Depression takes 4 years to really, well, 31. So it took 2 to 3 years to really build to a climax. And even then it was, you know, Germany first and then the British go off the gold standard. It's bit by bit. The big bank run doesn't start in America till 33, just as FDR's taking office and it really gets to New York for the first time. So there's nothing like 08. And we could be in a climate change kind of model of history in which there's nothing quite like what we've seen now, and the thing that we see next is even worse and even more dramatic, and we're getting there quite quickly.
Yeah.
And I'm not, that I think is a reasonable kind of scenario, but that is the way we need to think about this history, not as, oh well, there's financial crisis every 10 years and trade wars, financial crisis, broadly speaking, the same thing. Trade wars are slow, sclerotic kind of processes. Big impact on society over the long run. Financial crisis, unique moments of heart attack type phenomenon.
We're not heading for another one, are we?
Well, the only way you could see one, so this is then like, which kind of, if you look in the West, you'd say no. Like, you'd actually have to have a boom in Europe. So where's that?
Right.
Like, you know, would that we had any kind of symptoms, any bubbles that looked like they could burst, like, the US people pass and scan all the time, but you know, they find high, there's little things they focus on, but none of them look like they've really got the ingredients, because you need the bubble to burst, then you need a highly leveraged entity to be invested in it like a bank, and then you need its short-term funding to be unstable, and you need all those three elements, and there's none of that. The place where you do see all those elements is China. And so there's a lot riding on that, but then what you need is another place with a similar structure, because in the US it burst in 08 and Europe was the same way. So then you got this, you know, kind of critical mass of both systems going at the same time. There is China, and some people point at Japan and say there were risks in the Japanese banking system that look a bit similar. What I think we could have with China is a, is like an epic crisis in China, which could be really epic, and then we would get massive ripple effects from that. But it's I can't see how we would get a double explosion.
Right.
Now, 10 years, 20 years out, of course, the scenario is quite different. And the scale of things is rapid. I mean, it is, you know, in terms of global growth, the Anthropocene is the same story as the economic story, but in a different register.
Yeah.
So the scale of change in China, this rapidity of this of the debt build-up, you know, is like nothing we've ever seen before.
Right.
And we don't, you know, in the West, I'm not sure whether anyone can really see inside it, but what we see looks worrying. We don't know how much we can see. We don't know how much Beijing can actually see.
Yeah.
And, you know, conceivably, you know, to get a repeat of 08, you'd need India to do the same thing and then them both to explode at the same time. It doesn't look quite like we're there. But how the West would respond to a Chinese meltdown, we don't know. And under the present political management in the US, of course, that we wouldn't expect. You wouldn't expect the political cover to be there. But no doubt the Fed would know what it needed to do.
Yeah.
And maybe people inside the Treasury who do. And there's certainly big business in the United States which knows what it would want to have done. But it's very unclear whether the Republican Party and Congress and the White House right now would provide them with the political cover necessary.
Yeah.